Hello and welcome to this, the sixth in a series of podcasts from Polity. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this programme is David Held, who's Professor of Political Science at the London School of Economics. I met David last month to talk to him about his recent book, Cosmopolitanism, Ideas and Realities, which makes a case for a cosmopolitan approach to contemporary global politics. Jeremy Waldron of the New York University Law School has called the book as grounded and as comprehensive an account of the cosmopolitan agenda as one could wish for. In the interview, David Held outlines what characterizes his approach and explains why he believes it is the only viable alternative to current ways of tackling the problems that humanity faces, from financial crises to climate change. We also talk about the origins of cosmopolitanism, its compatibility with cultural diversity, and its incompatibility with fundamentalisms of various stripes. I took as my starting point, though, the post-World War II order, which seemed to be particularly conducive to political projects with cosmopolitan ideals, such as the United Nations and what would eventually become the European Union. I asked David to explain why that was so.
The Second World War was a moment of extraordinary violence in human history, but we shouldn't really see it in isolation. Really, if you look at Europe since the end of the 16th century, this was a moment at the end of the 16th century when Europe exploded out onto the world. Europe had made extraordinary advances in science, technology, in politics, in the organization of central power, in the concentration of military force. And the inventions of Europe, as it were used by Europe to explode out on the world, as I say, and to begin a process of colonization and the creation of empire, which lead, of course, in the late 18th and 19th century to Europe's enormous empires, of course, the most obvious example being the British Empire, which stretched across a third of the world's population and a quarter of the world's landmass, and was an era, this era of modernity and the concentration of the European modern state was also the period of colonization and empire. And Europe, during this period, was both the region of cultural attainment, cultural achievement, of the development of the idea of rights of individuals, the rights of the sovereign state, the notion of the beginnings of the notion of the modern state, democracy and accountability, at the same time as most of these achievements were denied to the peoples that were colonized and in the empires. There were rights for the insiders of Europe, those countries that were democratic, and no such rights for those, essentially, that were colonized by force and violence for the gain of Europe, the gain of Britain. Europe, in the 8th centuries, was the most violent region of the world. And then we come to the 20th century, where this violence is not just externalized anymore, but internalized in two extraordinary world wars, which leave Europe devastated by 1945, exhausted, collapsed. But not only did Europe exhaust itself as a result of these wars, what Europe unleashed, what Germany, Spain and Italy unleashed, was something on a scale of barbarism humanity had never seen before. And I think, of course, of the Holocaust, but not that, the Gulag in the Soviet Union, among other atrocities, industrialized atrocities. And so Europe, we come to the end of the Second World War, where people, not just the leadership of Europe, but the citizens of Europe and around the world, can begin to see what happens in human life if human interests and desires and needs and propensities are unchecked. Sovereignty was always that notion of absolute power, effective power. The 17th and 18th century notion of sovereignty in international law was essentially effective power. And this was because they couldn't claim sovereignty in countries that already had peoples in there before. The principle first come first serve wouldn't work because colonies, by their very nature, were prisoners of displacing indigenous peoples. So the notion of sovereignty was essentially might makes right, effective power. And this untrammeled, absolute concept of sovereignty fed into the sort of expansionist and barbaric tendencies of this culture and civilization that we think of ourselves as part of now. It wasn't Islam that brought the world to the edge of the abyss. It wasn't China that brought the world to the edge of the abyss. It wasn't the Third World that brought the world to the edge of the abyss. It was us, Europe, Europeans. And looking into this abyss, people saw that the nature of sovereignty had to be circumscribed, that the nature of what it is that protects human beings had to be circumscribed, that there had to be international covenants in place that would guarantee certain elements of international law, that would build on the law of war, but complement it with the laws of human rights conventions, the foundation of the UN, and also, of course, subsequently, the foundation of the EU itself. And here were momentous institutional developments in the context of the previous historical era, which sought to enshrine at their heart in the multilateral system and in the European system the notion of the equal moral worth of each and every human being. This idea that absolute power doesn't reside in states and what states demand and dictate, but in individual human beings who have inviolable sets of rights, and that legitimacy ultimately and sovereignty ultimately must be connected to these principles. And those principles which you just enumerated are the most significant constituents of cosmopolitanism in your account. They are. They are the living testimony that cosmopolitanism is not just an abstract political philosophy, but a set of achieved principles embedded in our post-war institutions for all their limitations and all their faults, that nonetheless show remarkable development in human beings' capacity to change the circumstances, the political circumstances of their lives. And these three principles are that the primary units of moral concern are individuals, not states, so that, as I have already said, that the notion that individuals have rights trumps the absolute nature of claims to sovereignty. Secondly, that this principle of the equal moral worth of each and every human being should be applied to everyone, not just citizens in a state, but everyone across the world. And that thirdly, that these principles, the principles of equal moral worth, individualism, what we call moral egalitarianism in more abstract language, and universalism, should be upheld within and beyond the borders of states. And this leads not just to a moral project, the defense of these principles, but to a political project that is then enshrined in the UN system, the multilateral order, and the EU, which for all its contemporary faults has abolished more or less successfully the notion that Europeans will fight each other.
And cosmopolitanism is a concept with a lineage, and you talk about its origins in the Stoics and ancient Greece, and you talk about Immanuel Kant and his sort of Weltbürger as another development of that concept. But is the uniquely 20th and 21st century development this enshrinement, this project to embed cosmopolitan ideas both in politics and in international law?
I think that's a very good summary. I mean, the Stoics are preoccupied with the notion that individuals have sort of two identities, one that is local and one that is truly global. They are members of a cosmos. And that membership of a cosmos relativizes attachments to the city-state and so on. The argument was that our attachments to families and city-states are morally arbitrary. We could have been born anywhere. We just happened to be born in certain places. And that the rights and duties which accrue to that kind of identity, that local identity, should be trumped by what it is that all human beings have in common, our membership of a wider cosmos. Kant takes a more individualistic view, but nonetheless for Kant, it is the upholding of the public role of reason that is critical to his project. For Kant, the Enlightenment signals the end of religious dogma and religious tradition, of absolutism in politics, as these old dogmatic power structures and forms of reason are held accountable to public life and the public use of reason. In the concepts of the 20th century cosmopolitanism, you find traces of this notion of a cosmopolitan citizenship, traces of this notion of the primary importance of the public justification of power and authority. But you have, above all of this, tied to this fundamental, elemental notion that there are certain basic values that set down boundaries or standards that no agent, whether a representative of a state or civil society, should ever be able to cross. And this focuses on the claims of each person as an individual. And these values espouse the idea that human beings are, in some senses, equal, whose rights enshrined in the Human Rights Conventions articulate the nature of this broad-based equality. And after hundreds of years, as it were, of nationalism, of nation-state formation, we may think these universal notions are out of date, but they're enshrined in elements of the laws of war, in the Human Rights Conventions, in the foundation of the UN, right the way up to the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and through elements of the EU, which is, after all, sui generis, and brings to an end the singular claims of European states, and forevermore compromises those claims of European states in the, by the virtual legal structure, the sui generis legal structure of the EU. So cosmopolitanism, in a nutshell, in the 20th century, links its distinctive claim to unpack the idea of the equal moral worth of every individual, regardless of politics, ethnicity, race, gender, class, a certain fundamental equality which should be protected wherever these people are born, wherever you are raised, no matter what your particular identities, the minimal standards of human dignity and achievement.
Now, the subtitle of your book is Ideas and Realities, and that, I think, points up a very interesting dichotomy. And if you take an example like the UN, you point out that on one hand there are principles, but in reality there are questions of funding, there are questions of partiality, there are questions of imbalance of power, there are questions of sort of flaccidity in policing, all of those militating against the actual implementation of the kind of concepts which you've just described and which the UN is supposed to uphold.
Yes, well, I think that is more or less perfectly put. I would just add two points, really, to this discussion. One is, the UN was always, as it were, born of a contradiction. It was created by the victors of the Second World War, and their distinctive power interest is embedded in their permanent membership of the UN Security Council, China later added on. So one might say that sovereign state interests, powerful sovereign state interests, were always spliced together with the universal aspirations of the UN Charter and so on. And the UN flip-flopped throughout its history on whether it is speaking, as it were, for the partiality of power or for these more universal claims. This contradiction is inherent. The second thing I would broadly say is that what we've learned from the history of the modern state is there is no state that can claim to be a modern, democratic, accountable state unless it meets two tests. One, that it doesn't depend simply on the rich for its taxation structure. That is, it doesn't depend on the rich making voluntary contributions. It has some system of compulsory universal taxation in which the rich are treated like any other, at least in principle. And secondly, this has a system of representation that doesn't depend on the king and the queen and the aristocracy and again the rich, but in some sense is universal. Most modern democracies roughly, more or less, approximate to this. They have universal taxation systems and they have general systems of representation. But the UN at the global level, we have political structures that singularly fail to meet these primitive tests. The revenues of the UN system are still dependent on the donations of the powerful states, and the system of representation is hopelessly skewed to the United States, to Europe and the big powers.
Now, if we wind the clock on from where we started at the end of the Second World War, there's a quotation which you make from Immanuel Kant again. You say, or rather he says, that we are unavoidably side by side, and that seems to have become even more true than it was when he said it. And you echo that in something you yourself say. You said the old threat was the other. The new threat is shared problems and collective threats. And that seems to me to be a very significant shift.
Globalization has a very long and complex history and takes many forms. In an earlier Polity Press book called Global Transformation, I and my co-authors documented this at great length, and I publish it with Polity, several books on globalization. But what I think they show is broadly, over time and historically, a shift to countries broadly able to set their own agendas and fates within the context of war and all of that, limitations, to a contemporary era where there's been a confluence of change across economics, politics, climate, environment, all these things that ensure that we do not live in a world of national communities of fate, but in a world I call overlapping communities of fate, where the fate and fortunes of countries are increasingly enmeshed. Think of the fallout from 9/11. Immediately, these planes struck the World Trade Center, the events of the significance of that ricocheted the world with to affect it for almost a decade. Think of the subprime mortgage markets, which no one had heard of in 2005 and 6. These were specialist subjects of investment bankers. And yet these became household concerns as the overage leverage of the banks and the creation of new investment vehicles, which the banks claimed would diffuse risk once and for all, concentrated risk so massively in the West that we saw something even more dramatic than Marx could ever have imagined. That is the utter interconnectedness of the world economy and the almost collapse of it in 2 weeks. Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto that the state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the bourgeoisie. And we've seen this in the global financial crisis, the perfect example of that. Who keeps the profits? The banking sector and the private sector. Who bears the cost? The citizens and the taxpayers. That's the outcome. This is a world, though, where risk is concentrated in certain powerful institutions, but the consequences of that risk ricochet across the world. So we live in a highly interconnected world, which on the one hand creates huge opportunity for all of us to develop and grow and to share knowledge. You think of the extraordinary achievements of China in the last 30 years. 300 million people lifted out of poverty as a result of China's engagement, successful engagement with the world economy. Similar numbers are beginning to show in India, in certain Latin American countries and elsewhere. None of this had been possible without globalization. So huge new opportunities. Think of the communication opportunities, the internet and all this as well. But against this, huge new vulnerabilities. The more interconnected we are, the more subject this system could be to destructive forces and devastation. So we live in a world of opportunity and extraordinary risk of development, a huge vulnerability, systemic vulnerability. And what are these huge new global problems thrown up by this system? Well, the most obvious one is climate change. But there's like a pyramid of global issues, or more if one wants to think of it slightly more depressingly, an iceberg of global issues drifting towards us. There are a whole series of issues that face, as it were, our habitat, the nature of the human habitat. Climate change, to ozone depletion, to water scarcity, water deficits, the spread of global infectious disease and so on. Then there are a series of mega issues which affect our life chances, the quality of our life chances, that affect the quality of the air we breathe, the water we consume, the foods we get, and all sorts of issues around that. And then finally, there are a whole series of issues now to do with our rules and who makes them, over trade, financial markets, nuclear proliferation, tax rules, finance rules, and genetic research rules. And the point that I want to really conclude with on this matter is that none of these issues anymore can be solved by nation states in isolation. Not even the United States, not even China. There is either a collective solution or there's no solution. And my book seeks to explore this tension. And where we sit at the moment, the direction of travel is not good, or is on the brink. I see three sets of possibilities that come from reflecting on the state of global negotiations on all the key issues that affect us. Multilateral trade negotiations in Doha, gridlocked. Financial market reform negotiations, gridlocked. Climate change negotiations, gridlocked. Nuclear proliferation, it's proliferating, gridlocked. These areas show that we face, on the one hand, the knowledge that markets and markets alone cannot solve these collective action problems. States and small clubs of powerful states can't solve these collective action problems without bringing in others as well. And yet, we do not have effective multilateral institutions or representative enough multilateral institutions to plot a clear way forward. These are uncertain, volatile times.
Because, of, as you've already suggested, there are such powerful geopolitical and geo-economic vested interests, aren't there? In whose interest it would not be to, as they would see it, cede power to some other supranational entity?
Well, you could say that economic globalization and multilateralism have been, in some ways, hugely successful. But course, in the last 60 to 70 years, they've helped create the conditions where new emerging powers can begin to assert their own voices and themselves on the world stage. India, China, Brazil, South Africa, Vietnam, and many others. This is a hugely significant change in the global balance of power. I think the balance of power in the world is changing faster than any moment in human history. We've gone from a world of bipolarity, the Cold War, to a briefly a world of unipolarity, the so-called American century, which came to an end, in my view, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now we face increasingly a world of multipolarity, of emerging and diverging voices. But here is a paradox. The more these voices assert their own sovereignty, the less they will be able to deal with the great collective action problems that I've just indicated. I call this the paradox of our times in the book we're talking about. On the one hand, the emergence of global problems that need global solutions. On the other hand, our evident realization that most of our institutions, national and global, remain stubbornly based on local culture, local identities, and systems of representation tied to territory.
That brings me on very neatly then to the next question. I mean, you say in the book, cosmopolitanism is, contrary to popular criticism, the triumph of difference and local affiliations. And people listening to this might raise an eyebrow at that, because what you've described is universal values and something which seems not to get into the specificity of local cultural practice, which may be at odds with some kind of universal value.
I think the principles that I mentioned earlier, above all the principles of the equal moral worth of each and every human being, and the self-determination of each and every human being, the principle of the self-determination of each and every being, are the condition for what I call just difference and the plurality of voices. After all, you can only have pluralism if pluralism is guaranteed by certain principles. You can only have democracy if democracy is guaranteed and underpinned by certain principles. If we are to have a world in which difference is not resolved by force or violence, if we have a world where arguments are not just to be finished by arbitrary points, one trumping another, then we need, as a core condition of the possibility of open debate, lively exchanges, lively politics, and so on, a system of politics that recognises what? The equal moral worth and self-determination of each and every one of us. Which means, on the one hand, we need principles that underpin that. On the other hand, we must recognise that if we are to live in the world with each other, our neighbours, and on the Kantian idea that we are unavoidably side by side in the world, then these principles need to underpin not just our local politics, but our national politics, our regional politics, and our global politics. Let me just paraphrase the American political philosopher and thinker Bruce Ackerman. He wrote, "There's not a country he knows of in the world without a woman who doesn't seek equal standing with those of the men around her, equal rights. There isn't a man in a country he knows in the world, or culture in the world, without men seeking to throw off the demands of deference and demands of power. I would add, there isn't a country in the world where people are not seeking to free themselves from the burden of unmet physical need and so on." The principles of cosmopolitanism are essentially the principles of democracy, stripped of one assumption that was never justified anyway, that these principles can only be tied and only embedded in the capsule, in the container of the nation state. And where do we see evidence of this realization today? To come back to where we started, in Europe. You can be a citizen of Glasgow and vote in the Glasgow elections. That same person can vote in the Scottish elections. That same person in the UK elections. And that same person in the European elections. Four overlapping forms of citizenship, all based on similar principles. And if that is not enough, not yet global citizenship, but engagement through NGOs and so on a plethora of global questions. So there we see the beginnings of the notion that in order for citizenship to be flourishing, it must be multi-level and multi-layered, guided by these common principles, which alone are the basis of the development of a pluralism that is tolerant of each and every person, that guarantees the voices of each and every person, and that yet recognizes that the outcome of such discussions will always be a compromise for us because we live in communities with others.
Does Islam present particular compatibility problems with cosmopolitanism?
Well, of course, it's since 9/11, it's been the popular Western view that Islam is the beginning of the basis, the seeds of a new war of civilizations. I think you can broadly say there is no truth in this at all, and for two reasons. Fundamentalism isn't just a problem of Islam. It's a problem of Christianity. It's a problem of Hinduism. It's a problem of Judaism. In all these religions and others, we can find fundamentalists. And who are they? They are the deniers of cosmopolitan values and principles, because they claim exclusive access to a set of doctrinal truths that are inhospitable and intolerant to rival truths. The opposite of pluralism, in some sense. All religions, not just Islam, have their fundamentalists. Second about Islam, Islam has actually historically been a very tolerant religion. You think of the spread of Islam across Europe over centuries. Let's take southern Spain, for instance. Southern Spain is littered with the legacy of Islam, but living side by side with Christianity, Judaism, and so on. And if you look at Islam today, there are many countries that maintain Islamic principles as the primary sources of their legislation that are also tolerant, that have seculars, that have constitutional states, that accept democracy, that are sympathetic to the emancipation of women, and so on. It is only in the last 20 years or 25 years that we've seen a radical Islam emerge as a geopolitical force. It was the great LSE professor of the Middle East Studies, Fred Halliday, who once said in one of his writings that Islam is not an expansion category. It's not an expansion category any more than Christianity is an expansion category. We can't say this is what happens in Europe because it's Christian. It doesn't give us enough purchase on the nature of the economy, state formation, state development, and so on. Islam too. So, broadly speaking, I resist entirely the claims that underpin that question, which I know you're putting to me just to explore these issues. But at the same time, we have to recognize that there are dangers in fundamentalisms. In Israel, there are dangers of Jewish fundamentalisms, the settlers, and so on, really destabilizing the possibility and prospects of peace. In the United States politics, we see the huge, powerful religious blocs that are very influential in U.S. politics, the drift to the right and always present in America, in North America. In India, we see both Muslim and Hindu extremists of various kinds. And so we see evidence of this in diverse places. No religion is alone responsible for fundamentalism. But all doctrines, secular or religious, can become fundamentalist.
David, I wanted to ask you finally about this tripartite relationship between democracy at the nation-state level and the market and cosmopolitanism. Tell me about the dynamic relationship, and does the augmentation of the strength of one necessarily mean the diminution of the strength of the others?
I think this is an area for very legitimate discussion and debate. First of all, when I think of my own project over the years, the working on globalization, cosmopolitanism, and so on, you know, I always stress when I'm teaching and when I'm giving papers about this that this is just my voice. This is my contribution to a very complex debate. Danny Roderick from Harvard has recently written a book where he says there's a direct trade-off, as it were, between these three points that you have set off. You can never have all three. At best, you can have two. Cosmopolitanism is a way of trying to resolve the dilemmas between these three points that you rightly point to. Because market fundamentalism throws up collective action problems that markets alone can't solve. Small clubs of states which have dominated world politics since 1945 have taken decisions almost inevitably in their own interest. You think of the Basel II conventions on banking standards. These were taken by small clubs of Western countries thinking about their own banking systems, and they took decisions which became, as it were, the gold standard for the world, but they were generalized a risk model that was peculiar to certain Western economies across the world, and the result eventually was the global financial crisis. So the club models have failed. The market model alone fails. The club models of non-democracy, as it were, fails. So that is why I say realism is dead, cosmopolitanism is the new realism. And that is to say, it is the only basis on which to solve the dilemmas between these three points. But to find out the details, you will have to read the book.
David Held. The book we were discussing, Cosmopolitanism, Ideas and Realities, is available now. You can find full details about it, as well as all of David's other Polity titles, on the Polity website at politybooks.com. I should in particular mention the Cosmopolitanism Reader, which David Held has recently co-edited with Garrett Brown of Sheffield University. I hope you'll join me again soon for another Polity podcast. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.